Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 22nd of March. Healthcare reform passed yesterday. It was a fascinating day to watch what was going on in the House of Representatives. The vote, of course, 219 to 212. It will go to the president for signature, perhaps as early as tomorrow. It happened fairly late last night at nearly midnight in Washington. A lot of the country was sleeping, of course. President Obama went into the East Room with Vice President Joe Biden and said, "I want to thank every member of Congress who stood up tonight with courage and conviction to make health care reform a reality. I know this wasn't an easy vote for a lot of people, but it was the right vote." Why wasn't it an easy vote? What will the ramifications be from this? How big a deal is the passage of health care reform? Was it absolutely necessary to keep this president having an effective presidency for the next at least 3 years? We've talked about this issue extensively for a year now, and so today we talk about what passed. Not everybody is happy with this. How large a vote was it? One of our guests a couple weeks ago said if this does pass, Nancy Pelosi will go down in history as being the best at her business of anybody, the best Speaker of the House. We'll ask our guest what he thinks of that. And he is Professor Mark Peterson, Professor of Public Policy and Political Science at the UCLA School of Public Affairs. He focuses on interactions among the presidency, Congress, and interest groups. How perfect a guest is he for today? Evaluating their implications for policy making. He was the editor of the Journal of Health Politics, Policy, and Law for quite a number of years. He has also been engaged with politics and policy making in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He was Democratic Party ward chair in the first ward and has also worked on many political campaigns. We'll be welcoming phone calls, I would expect many, as we've covered this for so many weeks. What are your thoughts about what happened in the House yesterday? What are your thoughts about this bill and the effectiveness of those who worked diligently on this? Was it a presidential victory because he became quite engaged the last few weeks of this debate? Was it a legislative victory, and does it show the effectiveness of Speaker Nancy Pelosi? We welcome your thoughts on this. So give us a ring or send an email. The telephone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Mark Peterson, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. Good morning, Kathleen.
Were you up late?
Oh, yes.
Now you're up early, too. I'm sorry, but thanks so much for being with us. Well, it really kind of went down to the wire here, didn't it? It was quite something to watch what was going back and forth yesterday and whether or not they had the votes. It was they needed every vote they got.
They needed pretty much every vote they got. Although, one thing, when you have controversial legislation like this that's hard on some members of the party that's pushing the issue, there's usually a reservoir of people who have committed their vote if needed, but would like to be able to vote against if possible. And so we don't really know how many of those members of the House there might have been in the Democratic ranks, but certainly by the time they reached the vote, it was all fairly certain it was going to pass.
Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of deals made that we will give you a pass, but if we need you, you'll vote for this.
Right. That's a very typical thing to do on both sides of the aisle.
How big a deal was this to have this passed? Two questions. Is it a very major piece of legislation? And two, was it crucial for this president?
In answer to the first question, it's huge. It's monumental. Presidents from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Truman to Richard Nixon to Jimmy Carter to Bill Clinton have all, in one way or another, envisioned moving in some direction like this to have an approach to getting to universal coverage in the country. And they have all either pulled back, like Roosevelt, because he thought it was an impossible task at the time, or they've just lost outright, Truman, Nixon, Carter, and Clinton. So to have finally have moved this forward with this president and this Congress is really of historic proportions. And it will go down in history as one of the most serious moments of decision-making by the White House and Congress on a piece of social legislation. In answer to your second question, it certainly makes a difference for the president's influence in Washington. We know from Bill Clinton, one can get pretty badly damaged politically if you lose on a big issue like health care reform, but we also know from Bill Clinton that there are ways to pull yourself back. After all, he did win re-election and ended up being one of the most popular presidents during the course of his 8 years. So it's not it was not a be-all or end-all situation, but certainly having this in the victory column for President Obama will make a very significant difference in his influence in Washington, in maintaining the confidence of the Democratic base that helped bring him to Washington, in inspiring the Democrats in Congress as they move forward. Of course, they've got rough political terrain coming up. This battle over health care reform does not end with this vote or even the Senate vote on the reconciliation bill. This battle is going to go right on into November. The Republicans have made it very clear this is going to be a central feature of their campaign, and the Democrats are going to have to be very effective in making a case, making the very clear case as to why this is not only historic, but is an extremely important and positive piece of action by the Congress.
We kept hearing from almost every Republican who was debating this yesterday that the American people are not in favor of this. The American people are opposed to this. Do you have a sense of where we are on this? There have been some who have said once this passes, it will become, and it has, the law of the land. And a few months from now, it will just be accepted as such, and there will not be a whole lot of controversy about it.
I think it will take longer than a few months, but it is very important to be clear about a number of points. Yes, if you ask in surveys going into this vote, are you for or against this legislation, it was a little bit on the negative side, fairly balanced, but a little bit on the negative side. Now, the problem is that's asking this legislation as it's been characterized, including by the opponents, in ways that are just not at all factually accurate. And so the question is once people do see what is in the bill, but it's going to take a while for that to trickle out, will they have a more favorable response? One of the things that we know is that the surveys also ask about component pieces of the legislation. And in terms of the basic components of the legislation, there's actually quite a bit of strong support. And if the Republicans were going to go by polling numbers, then they should have been front of the line putting forward the public option, because the public option in almost every state was a supermajority support in public opinion polls. So these polls are very easy to read in various ways. The proof will be in the pudding. The legislation's now been passed. Can the Democrats make it clear to the American public what's in the bill? A lot of the features of the bill will not go into place until 2014. So there's going to be a long period of time where there's been all this action and all this dust and all this unsettling political warfare, and yet most people really won't see anything tangible for quite a while.
Right. What is in this bill? These bills are huge, the reconciliation bill and the health reform bill. They're thousands of pages long. There are a lot of things in it that we don't know about, I would imagine.
Well, there are, and a lot of them are very favorable. But as someone who's worked in the Senate, I have to tell you that the page number issue is silly in the end for a number of reasons. One is any time you pass any legislation that has any ramification for any existing program, you have to have language in the bill about how those programs will be affected. Number two, if you've ever seen the bill, you'll notice that the type is very big, the margins are really wide, and there's a lot of space between each line. Not like reading Moby Dick. It's a very different kind of presentation, and so the page numbering doesn't tell you very much. But Derek, what's interesting, one of the interesting things about this legislation is the battles, the political confrontations, the characterizations on each side, the fight. Fights have all been about primarily the issues having to do with financing and reorganization and tweaking of the healthcare financing system and the insurance system in particular. There's actually a lot in this bill about experiments to improve the health delivery system. There's an enormous amount in this bill about increasing investments in public health and creating new opportunities for communities to organize programs to improve population health. In other words, to do things to try to keep people healthier longer so they don't have to go into the medical system as soon as they do now. A lot of these things may, in the end, we don't have firm evidence yet, but may, in the end, actually make tremendous progress in holding down costs. And they certainly should make tremendous progress in increasing the health of the American public and reducing the kinds of disparities that exist across different populations.
Let's talk about the president's leadership on this. The Times had an interesting piece yesterday talking about Nancy Pelosi saying, listen, the time to have for this to happen is now. If we're going to go out there and really work hard on this, you've got to show us more leadership than you have. Did she budge him to move more, nudge him to move more here and take a much more active role? A couple questions. Was it her urging that got him moving?
I don't think, I certainly think it helped. My guess is that the president was waiting for the moment. He knew fully that he was going to have to be invested in the bill and put the weight of the presidency behind it. The question really always was, when was he going to do that? They were clearly in the White House working off of a strategy that looked at what happened to Bill Clinton's efforts in 93, 94, put that up to a mirror and did the opposite. So where Bill Clinton drafted the plan in quietly behind closed doors in the White House, Obama let Congress go forward with the details and have ownership of it. Where Bill Clinton was invested right from the very beginning and said, my presidency is staked on this bill, Obama was waiting over a period of time when there was a moment for him to come in. In a variety of ways, they chose to act to develop a strategy that was very much a mirror image or a reversal of the approach that Bill Clinton took. Another big part of it was just the plan to begin with. Bill Clinton had a vision of how to get to universal health care insurance and to use entirely new institutions, health alliances, and so on to get there. The Obama folks decided right from the beginning, in fact, during the campaign, that they were going to approach this as whatever one might think about the employer-based system in the long term, it's not worth politically trying to tinker with it, and instead we'll let most people stay exactly where they are if they're happy with that.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy Pelosi, I referred to our guest a couple weeks ago, who said she will be considered the greatest Speaker of the House if indeed this passes.
I'm not sure the greatest Speaker of the House. There'd be some competition for that, but there's no question that she will go down in history as one of the most effective Speakers of the House. And it really was an extraordinary performance on her part to get this done. I think even her colleagues on the Republican side of the aisle give her a great deal of credit for making this happen. They're not happy about it. They wish she had been less effective, but they do recognize the skill that she brought to bringing the vote forward and bringing forward the success.
And is it, when we look at this historically, Professor Peterson, is it something that has happened before that you have had a major piece of legislation on a purely partisan vote?
That's very unusual. It's certainly been the case we've passed major pieces of legislation with an overwhelming majority of one party against the majority of the other party, but some members of the other party have almost always been on board. The only time that hasn't been the case is prior to the Obama administration was when Bill Clinton's budget was passed in 1993 without a single Republican vote in either the House or the Senate. It's clearly not the way you'd like to do things, But here you also have to put things in context. One of the things that's extraordinary about not having any Republican votes this time is to think about what's actually in the bill and how it's structured. I would make the argument, and I think I can make it very forcefully, that the bill that passed is the most conservative and most Republican version of health care reform that has ever been in a central place on the nation's agenda. Even the individual mandate derived originally from both Governor Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts, a Republican governor, and going back to the early 1990s when the Senate Republicans were structuring their alternative to Bill Clinton's approach, they had an individual mandate as opposed to any kind of employer mandate or other financing mechanism. So here you have, and of course the Obama plan uses the private insurance industry, including a commercial private insurance industry. It didn't used to be a for-profit industry so heavily, but today it's dominated by for-profit. He's left that in place. A lot of the pieces of the bill look like what Republicans would have put forward in the 1990s and the 1970s. Even Republican Richard Nixon's plan, his comprehensive health insurance plan, was built on an employer mandate and a large-scale financing on the public side of a public plan for those who would not get employer-based insurance. That plan would have been, quote-unquote, well to the left of the plan that Obama put forward.
Phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Mark Peterson. He is a professor of public policy and political science at the UCLA School of Public Affairs. We're talking, well, it's all things political. So the next thing on the agenda will be something easy like immigration. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, senior editor of The Atlantic, Joshua Green, on his profile on Timothy Geithner in the current issue of the magazine, Inside Man. Let's go to phone calls. We start with Amanda from Eau Claire. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. My question is about legal immigrants in the country. We've been following everything that's been going on really closely, and there seems to be a lot of talk about what will happen for illegal immigrants or won't happen for legal immigrants with this bill, but I haven't been able to find anything about what legal immigrants would be eligible for or not eligible for. I don't think a lot of people realize that legal immigrants now are really not eligible for a lot of services, depending on how they came in. And so we're just curious what this bill might do for legal immigrants.
Well, my understanding, Amanda, is that anyone who's in the country legally and appropriately documented, for instance, can participate in the state insurance exchanges and be able to buy insurance from among the various options that are being provided will be provided in that exchange, and I believe will be have access to the various programs that are part of this. There's a very strongly drawn line that undocumented immigrants will not have access to the exchange, for instance, even if they could pay for the premiums entirely on their own without any subsidy support.
And speaking of immigration, is that next tier? Talk about another issue that's filled with not much agreement.
That's going to be a very, very tough issue. It's another one where most people believe something needs to be done. There's probably even a good deal of agreement on some issues across the aisle. There's the emerging bill put together by Senator Schumer from New York and Senator Lindsey from South Carolina. But the Lindsey has said that if the Democrats pass health care reform on a party line vote this way, that would be the end of immigration reform, or at least the end of the possibility for bipartisan negotiation. We'll have to see how that actually plays out. I'm not sure on an issue of that scope why the health care reform vote ought to end any progress on immigration reform, but that might have just been a way to try to add pressure to the Democrats to be diverted.
Thanks, Amanda. Jim from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to talk today about the hatred that came out of this health debate for people that are different, and especially the poor, and the begrudging attitude towards the poor. And just think of some of the things that we've seen in the press and heard on TV. The scorn heaped on the person that had Parkinson's disease. The use of the N-word towards black congressmen by the protesters, and also the fact that one of them was actually spat at, and Barney Frank being called various derogatory terms for gay people, and Stupak being called a baby killer in the House of Representatives. And a comment that was in today's Chicago Tribune said, just because you got a wish doesn't mean that it's a right. If you want health care, you go and get health care or work for it. But it's not your fault if somebody cuts your health care while you're working, or if, as part of your work, they didn't give you the health care benefit. And the final point I want to make is that Leonard Pitts wrote in today's Chicago Tribune Beck's Gospel of Extreme Paranoia. Glenn Beck claimed that people that were for social justice and economic justice were analogous to communism and Nazism. And Jim Wallace from Sojourners pointed out that there are over 2,000 verses in the Bible about the poor, God's concern for the people that are left out and the vulnerable, and that if you cut all these verses out of the Bible would be in tatters. And so, you know, it's just sad to see all this hatred from people that have this "I've got mine, and if you didn't get yours, the hell with you" attitude.
Professor Peterson.
I agree. I think it's always sad to see in any political discourse, whatever side one is on, whatever party is pushing that particular issue, to see that kind of language used, seeing that kind of visceral, as you say, hatred or anger become so pronounced. And what's the two things that are particularly disturbing about it in the current context is that we've advanced so far, and we hate to see falling backwards in some ways in terms of bigotry and hatred expressed towards people. We've got a problem with all the virtues of the new media. We have also the downsides that people can be very readily agitated through the Internet. There's all kinds of things available on the Internet or in some of the cable shows, unfortunately, like Glenn Beck, where instead of focusing on where there really are deep principled ideological value differences that need to be discussed and put forward, they get translated in some of the most bizarre ways and disconnected from reality. And it feeds the fears and angers that people have. And clearly, the healthcare reform debate has really stoked an enormous amount of passion, has stoked an enormous amount of fear among various people. And here's the thing that's really worrisome is that the primary mainstream leaders who really should be providing for a more responsible way of thinking about these issues have not taken a stand and said that these things are not only unacceptable, but that they recognize that perhaps the way the debate has gone forward has made it more likely for this kind of discourse to happen rather than less likely.
Here's an email that's come in. We have many of them, actually. I deeply resent the use of the anti-abortion button issue and Obama's executive order at the last minute, putting health care reform on the backs of women. The way it was done ensured that no one had time to protest or voice their opinion.
This is the abortion issue has been in the background on the healthcare reform debate front for decades, and it has come to the fore only when the bill has actually gotten to a point near passage. It is another one that goes to deep passions and strongly held views. It is there are people who have votes in Congress who favored every other aspect of the bill. Except their concerns that $1 of federal funding would go towards an abortion, and they were willing to bring it down on that basis because of how the principle they hold to on that, on the issue of abortion, and that's what makes these politics so complicated. It's what's made it so difficult to imagine for Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who herself has a fairly strong record among the pro-choice set, having to, in her view, engage in these compromises in order to bring this forward. The two compensating things to say for those who are concerned about the issue is that, one, there will be another day and there will be other opportunities to challenge those policies in the future. The other is one of the most important things about the health of women has to do with ensuring that, one, women are not charged a different rate for simply being a woman, as the speaker pointed out last night, and the other is just to ensure that people in general have access to good, high-quality health care, both and during pregnancies, before pregnancies, in the course of planning the reproductive health. And we're now going to be adding, according to the estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, adding 32 million people to the insured ranks. My guess is that a good number of them are women, and they are going to have access to better care and probably access to all kinds of things that will, in the end, reduce the number of unwanted pregnancies, provide for better health care for them, and also provide for better health care for the children they want to have.
Charity is next from Wausau. Hi, Charity.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Professor Peterson, I'm just wondering, I know this has probably been discussed before, but I think today is kind of an important day to bring it up again. This bill is passed now, and a lot of people are going to benefit from this. I'm just wondering if you might be able to discuss briefly why are the Republicans so against this? Against this bill, if it includes so many ways to improve the quality of life for their constituents, and you know, why aren't they more invested in the well-being of their constituents rather than these points which are, you know, that can be amended later or, you know, worked out later on?
It's a very, very good question, but I think also, to be fair, that there are many Republicans, one, who are representing their constituencies very well. The Republicans who are in Congress right now are primarily, at least in the House of Representatives, primarily from congressional districts that are themselves very conservative, very concerned about the reach of government power, very much focused on the notion of individual responsibility, wanting to avoid dependency on Washington. These are all the things that they both say and believe quite deeply. And so there are a lot of Republicans who are opposed to this because they view, although there would be some health insurance benefits for constituents, they view it as a fundamental challenge to their understanding of what makes America strong and powerful and unique in the world, and that is the focus on a free market economy that is not interfered with by government regulation, and a society in which it's expected that every individual will carry his or her own weight and not put out a hand to what they would characterize as a kind of European-style government that provides so many benefits.
Mm-hmm. The problem with that, though, and I want to talk about the significance of the number of people who will be insured now, is that so many people, be a Republican or Democrat or whatever the heck you are, that insurance can be fragile for people, and it has affected so many people, regardless of their political persuasion. How important is it, the number of people who are now being insured who were uninsured, and don't most Americans embrace that it is something that we should all have? It is a right for us.
For decades now, the American public expressed in polls have said that, number one, that a lack of income should not be a barrier to getting high-quality care, and number two, that everybody should have access to good quality care and by that also have the insurance coverage that gets them there. The disagreements always come into how one does that. And obviously, that's most Americans. It's not every American. There's a significant percentage of the American public, probably on the order of 20-25%, who simply think it's wrong for government to play this kind of role and to take away, in their view, the individual's responsibility for tending to these things. Now, it's going to make an enormous difference, no matter who you are, Democrat, Republican, Independent. To have these kinds of insurance protections, if you already have insurance, and to have access to a much less expensive way to get insurance. Where the divisions are, for instance, a lot of Republicans would tell you in Congress that they're for expanding coverage and that they're for bringing down costs for everyone. They are more willing to, for instance, open up a market in which everyone could just simply go onto the Internet and buy whatever insurance plan they could find anywhere in the country, at whatever price that they're willing to pay. The problem is the Democrats and others on the other side would say if you don't have any regulatory structure, people will be buying a lot of really crummy insurance and end up in the category of what we in the field call the underinsured, thinking they have coverage, and then something happens and finding out they really don't. And that's really where the debate is, how much that would be true. Would it be possible to bring down costs and give people more insurance or the opportunity for more insurance by opening up a completely a more free market approach rather than bringing in a more of a regulatory approach and a subsidy approach?
I see. And what do you think that same number of people believe that Medicare is not a good program?
Well, I'm glad you've raised this question, Kathleen, because one of the frustrating ironies of this political debate is the Republicans, in striving to get political grounding for their challenges to the bill, have become the major supporters of Medicare, and apparently don't want any reductions in Medicare spending, which is extraordinary given previous positions they've taken, including what was passed in the Republican Congress in 1995. But frankly, if you take the argument to the logical place that would seem to be the place to go, rather than supporting Medicare, they should be saying, recognizing that Medicare is the single largest government-financed single-payer system in the world. Well, let's throw in the veterans' health system as well. That's one of the largest national health services. It's not only financed by government, but the doctors and the nurses are government employees. Those are embodiments of what one would think of as government, deep government involvement in healthcare. And certainly, if you're opposed to the level of government involvement that is encapsulated in the bill that was passed last night, one should be opposed to Medicare, one should be opposed to Medicaid, one should be opposed to the VA health system.
We go to Diane from Middleton next. Hi, Diane.
Good morning, and thank you.
You're welcome.
I seem to understand that, rightly or wrongly, that 51% of the, or 51 senators had said that if the House would, if there would be a public option in the reconciliation bill, that they would vote for it. And yet, it wasn't put forward in the reconciliation bill, and I don't understand about all that.
That's an excellent question, Diane. It's and of course, it gets to be a very, very confusing part of the story because of the role of reconciliation and now going back to the Senate, and what would the Senate really do in the context of now its own bill having been passed in the House. The problem with the public option in these terms is a certain number of senators signed on to the letter formally saying that they would support a public option. There are a number of senators who were put into that category who did not sign on to the letter, who as a matter of general abstract principle would like to see a public option, but who felt that moving in that direction would have taken down the vote in the House and would have made it much harder for there to be a vote in the House in the first place. And so they didn't really sign on to the letter, but they've been certain groups like MoveOn.org have put them into that category because at various times in the past they had expressed support. When it comes down to the end game of this kind of legislative process, it's a very delicate dance, and the one thing that looks obvious that you might put in could actually disrupt getting any bill at all out of the other chamber. And I think that's what ultimately happened to the public option, to the chagrin of many people in the House, many people in the Senate, and certainly many people in the Democratic base, among others, who had been looking for a greater opportunity to bring competition to the for-profit insurance industry.
And what is their long-term response to this? Do they then try to find more and more candidates who are strong public option proponents to run in elections, or do they take this and just swallow it with a grain of salt, or what?
Well, this is never an end to the process. We're at another beginning. If you go back to Social Security and you go back to Medicare, there are many things about the original versions of those statutes as they were passed that were very limiting and very, in many ways, quite undesirable. But they put in place a framework on which one builds. And so, for instance, when Medicare was originally passed, there was no separate federal agency to run it. It was being run by the Social Security Administration. No federal bureaucrat was ever going to make contact with a physician or a hospital, so there had to be private intermediaries who actually did the paperwork because doctors refused to deal with federal so-called federal bureaucrats. The payment structure more or less said the doctors and hospitals, tell us what we owe you and we'll pay you, and that led to an enormous amount of cost increases within Medicare as physicians and hospitals kept upping their payment requirements, and that ultimately led to a reorganization of the program in a way that brought about a much more sensible approach to financing. We're going to see with health care reform that, in fact, there is no end date on it. This is going to be a constant struggle that goes forward, and one of the things that may happen on the Democratic side is over the coming years, Democrats may try to push new legislation that would, in fact, bring about a public plan that could compete with the private plans. We may get all kinds of changes as we go down the road as health care costs continue to go up, as there are more and more people who go into Medicare as they age into Medicare, as the health system. This bill by no means brings a fiscal control over the health care system in a way that a lot of people would like to see, and it's just going to be an ongoing struggle.
Thanks for the call, Diane. Tom from Oshkosh. Hi.
Good morning. My question to your guest is, in the run-up and the discussion, there were threats that perhaps this bill could be repealed. And how seriously do you think we need to take that threat? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tom. That's certainly been the position that the Republican opposition has taken now. Of course, they couldn't do anything about repeal unless they get a majority of the House and the Senate, and big majorities. at that, because obviously that they've demonstrated that if you don't have absolutely super-duper supermajorities, the minority party can bollock things up. So repeal would require very significant majorities on their part. The one caveat to that, it would still require majorities, but one thing that they're thinking about doing is breaking up the repeal into pieces so that they would try to force the Democrats to have to vote against things like putting more money into Medicare. In other words, to get rid of any of the cuts that were made in Medicare and make it look like the Democrats are going after Medicare by not voting for repeal. So they're going to try, if they're in a position to do so, they will try to set up votes that will make it very difficult politically for the Democrats. But again, it's going to depend on their having a majority. And that's going to depend on their orchestrating now a scorched earth campaign between now and November to try to persuade the American public that this health care bill is, in fact, a direct threat to the American economy and to American principles of liberty.
All things political dominated by health care reform naturally this hour because of yesterday's vote in the House. Our guest is Professor Mark Peterson. He's a professor of public policy and political science in the Department of Public Policy at the UCLA School of Public Affairs. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, we're going to be speaking with the senior editor of The Atlantic, Joshua Green, on Timothy Geithner. Here's another email that has come in. This one is from Bill from Madison. I realize that one advantage of the bill is that no one can be denied insurance. But from what I understand, insurance companies can still effectively deny coverage by upping the price if people have pre-existing conditions. If this is true, how likely is it that people will be just as brutalized by the insurance system as they were before the bill goes into effect?
It's Bill, that's an important question, and obviously one of the things that's happened in the past when we've passed legislation such as the Kassebaum-Kennedy bill in the 1990s, which was intended to provide a means for people to hold on to insurance if they lost it, if you don't control price, then they can be priced right out of the market. It's a very important question. My understanding in this case is there are much greater constraints on what insurance companies can do to raise premiums. There are constraints as to how high they can go between, for instance, a young person versus an older person. There's also going to be a new federal structure that will require its approval for major insurance rate increases, for instance. So I think there are much greater protections in this bill than there have ever been in the past, in ensuring that not only can people really not be denied because of pre-existing conditions, denied coverage, but they also cannot be priced out of the market.
And let's go next to Horda from Eagle River. Hello.
Hello. I wanted to ask if there's any immediate restriction on annual or 8-month rate increases, premium increases for self-employed people who have major medical health insurance policies. Mine goes up about 100 or 200 a month every year.
Yes, this is happening across the country to all kinds of people. The bill, I do not think, has any immediate impact on that. The one thing the bill does provide is that for those who are finding themselves eventually pushed out of the individual market, there will be a high-risk pool market that the federal government will heavily subsidize, so that people can have access in the interim to insurance coverage that will be less expensive than the market would provide. It will not be until, I think it's 2014, when there is the full operation of the insurance exchanges within the states, that people who are currently in the individual market will have access to real competition within the insurance market, being able to choose among plans, many plans, who will, one, have to take you, and two, will be competing with lots of other insurance plans for your business, and also with the provision of subsidies to help people at certain income levels afford the insurance. So that day, that better day, if you will, is going to be some years off, because it takes a while to really create these kinds of new institutions. But in the short term, there is the protection of the high-risk pool insurance that states have been providing in the past in some cases, but not very effectively. Now the federal government will be doing it.
It seems as though one of the factors in helping this to pass was insurance companies like the major one in California that were giving 40-50% increases in premiums. I'm sure that that made a lot of people pretty upset.
It did, and many people have been experiencing that. One of the problems that this bill deals with is that for those who cannot get insurance coverage through employment, they are, if they're going to get insurance, they're forced into what's called the individual market. In the individual markets, when insurance companies sell to a big employer, they like big employers because it means there are lots of people, and so the risk of illness among any a number of them is spread out among a large pool, and so the insurance companies don't feel they have to engage in what's called medical underwriting to see who's going to be sick and who's not in order to avoid the sick. If you're in the individual market, there is no group that you're part of. You are just there with your own individual risk, and so an insurance company, and it's a sensible business model in the context of the way things are set up, is to ensure you're not selling insurance to someone who's going to be a lot more expensive than the insurance premiums will provide. As people who are healthier see these rising premiums, they decide to drop insurance and just go on the good luck that they're not going to get sick, which means that people who remain in the insurance plan are increasingly those who have high-cost conditions. So the premiums go up, and you get into what is ultimately a potential what they call death spiral. And what we've been seeing in some of these premium increases is simply the evidence of that in play, that the individual market, because it's not pooling risk, is having to price, from the point of view of the insurance companies, according to what someone's actually going to cost. And that, of course, goes against the understanding most people have of insurance as a risk pool and spreading risk and having all of us pay a more even amount and not to effectively be paying the entire cost of our illness.
Mm-hmm. Wayne is next from Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hey, good morning to the guest. I have two quick points, and your guest is being very fair, so I'm looking forward to his answer. One would be the New England Journal of Medicine released a poll recently in polling their membership, which are practicing physicians. What would you do now if this legislation passes? And the 8% of the respondents said that they would quit the practice now and go into another field. 22% they would retire earlier. And I think your guest would admit we don't have a glut of physicians currently practicing medicine. And my second point would be I understand there's over 30 states that are going to file lawsuits against the federal government. And the first one would be Virginia, and I think that comes Wednesday if our president signs legislation tomorrow. I'd just like to ask your guest what his thoughts are, and does he think this might head to the Supreme Court in the final analysis if that many states do file? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Wayne, thanks.
A whole series of important questions, Wayne. In terms of the last one, the states filing, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but my sense from reading the literature and knowing something about the past process here is that these state suits probably have no chance of going anywhere. It doesn't mean it won't end up in the Supreme Court, but it would be a shocker for the Supreme Court to go against the tide of constitutional interpretation over the last many, many decades, almost 100 years, about what the federal government can do when interstate commerce is involved. In terms of how doctors are going to respond, and of course this is, with any change, a very significant question. And we don't really know, and the doctors are giving us their impressions in the poll that's reported. But we don't really know how they're going to respond in the end. There was a great deal of concern that doctors were not going to participate in Medicare, for instance, when it was enacted. And of course, the program was designed in many ways to keep them enticed. But nonetheless, they did not want to participate in a government-financed healthcare program. In the end, the vast majority of doctors participate. In fact, the vast majority of doctors in recent years have been on what's called assignment, which means that they will take direct payment from Medicare and not require the patient to work through the process of getting reimbursed. It's usually the case that once the dust settles and everybody understands the sensitivities and it's trying to be responsive to the needs of the different kinds of providers, that providers end up wanting to continue to participate. I think, frankly, one of the things that's been most disconcerting for physicians over the last few decades is the extent to which their decisions about medical practice have been overtaken by the insurance industry. They're having to call up, they're being second-guessed by insurance companies that have people sitting at computers with particular protocols for particular conditions. And that's very frustrating if you're a physician and think that you're practicing the medicine the best way you know how. Interestingly, in the 1990s, for instance, when we last had a healthcare reform debate and issues like this came up, it was doctors in Germany and doctors in England who were more likely to recommend to their children to go on into the medical profession than doctors in the United States, in part because they had freer clinical practice decision-making in those countries. And so I think the real issue will be is what doctors ultimately experience is they have more patients who can pay because they're covered by insurance and find that there really isn't anything in this legislation that is going to be the federal government telling doctors how to practice medicine.
Saeed from Green Bay, hi.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. As I listen to this conversation, it strikes me as quite imbalanced in that it would be wonderful if you had somebody like Paul Ryan or George Will or a conservative that could defend the position of being opposed to this bill. I'm opposed to this bill.
Right. We have a request in for Paul Ryan. We hope he'll be here later this week.
I don't accept any of the ill intent that your speaker assigns to anyone who is opposed. Let me tell you, I too would like every American to be covered. I spend a career in medicine caring for Medicare patients and for the uninsured and for people who can't pay me. But I'm very, very concerned about what's going to happen here. This bill increases our taxes by $569 billion. It creates 160 new bureaucracies. Your speaker is right. I don't want anyone between me and my patients, insurance companies, or the government. And now 160 new bureaucracies are going to be inserted there. 16,500 new IRS agents. This is the largest unfunded, this is the mother of all unfunded mandates, as 16 million Americans are going to be pushed into Medicaid, which it's state-funded. Every gimmickry has been used to not properly economically score this this bill. And let's talk about Medicare. 40% of my practice is Medicare. 80% of my practice-related stress is Medicare because these are older, sicker patients that I care for. 15% of my income is from Medicare. Okay? Now the government is proposing to cut Medicare by $500 billion. I can practice and take care of these patients because private insurance subsidizes my existence. If you take private insurance away and all I have is Medicare, I am closed. This is why Mayo Clinic Jacksonville no longer takes Medicare patients. This is why Walgreens will no longer accept Medicaid. The fact that what I'm telling you here is truth will be proven by the next bill that is going to be introduced, which is called the Medicare Fix Bill. The Medicare Fix Bill, which is going to stop the reduction in Medicare funding for physicians. They didn't include it in this bill as a gimmickry, because if they did include the Medicare Fix Bill, it would show that that this bill is already on the red before it comes out of the gates.
Okay, let's get a response. Professor Peterson.
Well, thank you. And those are clearly the themes that have been raised by those who are opposed to the bill, most of those who are opposed to the bill. And fortunately, you'll have Representative Ryan on to carry that charge as well and see how the response goes. Every time there is a bill like this, there's 161 new bureaucracies and so on. If you look below the surface, we're not setting up 161 new departments of health and human services and bureaucrats are going to come in and tell doctors how to practice. It just is not the case. However, this does involve a role of government that many people oppose. The other two things I'll say very quickly, because I know I can't really, in the time we have here, deal with the number of issues that he raised that were at the center of the debate and the center of the confrontation between the Democrats and Republicans on this issue. But one, Medicare, many of about $138 billion of the cuts in the Medicare, projected Medicare spending, come out of subsidies that go to private insurance companies. The private insurance companies and Medicare Advantage, those companies were originally drawn into the program under the thinking that managed care plans can provide higher quality care at lower cost than traditional fee-for-service medicine, which is the way most of Medicare is set up. So let's bring in those plans, give people a choice, and they'll save us money. It's now been turned around to, for some reason, we ought to have private plans, even though they're costing, on average, 18% more for those Medicare beneficiaries than those Medicare beneficiaries would cost in traditional Medicare. So we are subsidizing for-profit private insurance plans simply to be present in Medicare and not to do provide higher quality care at lower cost. That's one of the things that the bill deals with.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time.
Sorry.
Yeah, Professor Peterson, thank you. You're a great guest. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, Professor Mark Peterson, Professor of Public Policy and Political Science in the Department of Public Affairs, Public Policy, rather, UCLA School of Public Affairs. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this program. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls. They're good ones, always. We have news coming up, and we'll return with more Monday conversation here on the Ideas Network.